You are listening to Drawn to Comics, the podcast about a couple of guys that are just drawn to comics. My name is Russ.
My name's Ken.
We're recording at Vitzy Mama's, a Mexican restaurant in downtown Glendale, not far from Ken's comic book store, Drawn to Comics.
Dude, we love this place so much, I think they're going to start giving us our own parking space out there.
We definitely have our own booth. When I walk in, she says, honey, your booth in the back? I say, absolutely. Cup of coffee? Yes, please. Yes. The ball's rolling from there pretty soon. Huevos rancheros in my face.
Tons of eggs, tons of bacon. Lulu takes care of the pigs and the chickens very well around here.
So if you're listening to Drawn to Comics for the first time, Drawn to Comics is the name of Ken Brown's comic book store in downtown Glendale, recently nominated by TravelandLeisure.com as the fifth best comic book store to visit in the country. Is that right?
Yes, it still amazes me to this day that out of all the great comic shops in the country, we rank number five. And it's awesome to see, because I said too, we do this because we love it.
Yeah.
Not to get any kind of like recognition. It's great to see the recognition, but it just shows, I mean, that to me is like really, it sounds weird, but heartwarming to see how much of an impact we make in the comic community.
Well, that doesn't sound weird at all. You opened in 2005 in downtown Glendale in a much smaller space. What was it, some 600 square feet or something like that?
Yes, 550 square feet.
Unbelievable.
It used to be a bail bond storage room office.
I've lived in studio apartments bigger than that.
Yes.
And you were running a comic book store there. And you gradually moved into a beautiful corner space with a great storefront.
Yes.
Big display windows in downtown Glendale. So you earn it, man. You've earned it.
Thank you and your family and your hard work,
your great staff. If you are anywhere in or around the metropolitan Phoenix area ever, you got to swing by Drawn to Comics because they will greet you at the door warmly, show you to what you want to see in the comic book store, or leave you alone and let you shop. Whatever your experience preference is, these guys are all about it. So
yeah, we're Drawn to Comics. The name of it just comes from the fact like we're drawn to comics, attracted to comics just as much as you are. And we can share that love with you guys. That's what makes me happy every day, and that's why I decided, hey, you know what? I'm going to try to do something I have the passion for.
Sure.
Give it 24 months, 2 years. If it's not going a positive direction, I could at least say I tried. And anybody that does something they, you know, love and they want to just give it a shot at it, do it. I don't want to hear about anybody saying, man, I wish I did that, because I thought about that really hard myself. There's a lot of obstacles to whatever you love in life. And, you know, failure is an option, but success is a better option.
Nice.
And just keep at it and, you know, find out what you love to do and go for it. That's all I can say on that.
2.5 minutes into the podcast, you're already giving fatherly advice to our audience. It's wonderful. This is what makes Ken amazing. And full disclosure, I'm not on the store's payroll. I don't work at Drawn to Comics. I'm just such a fan of what Ken and his wife Sue have been able to do here in downtown Glendale, that it's an honor to partner with him for a podcast and
to be his friend.
So, yeah, absolutely.
Mr. Hey, it's an honor. I love working with you.
They can't see that, but we just shook hands. It was
yes, it's our bro hug, man.
I self-publish a mini comic book called Amazing Arizona Comics. It satirizes Arizona news, history, and culture with superhero adventure. Flagship characters include Speed Cameron, the living Speed Camera, June Monsoon, Dust Devil. So you can see how I use tropes of Arizona living, and I make it into a standard superhero comic book. It's a mini comic book, self-published since 2010. So what you get in this podcast is a look from Ken's perspective, the retailer's view, the guy that's selling the comics. And then here I am, a guy that makes comics and self-publishes and sells them. So we hope to offer that unique perspective compared to other podcasts that are just kind of fan-driven.
Yes.
We're a little closer to being, I mean, we're not like in the industry, but we are very close. We're industry adjacent.
Yes.
Wait, is that fair to say, Ken?
That's like industry adjacent. It's like a perfect term for it. I mean, where we're on the front line every day,
right,
but we don't always have the same freedoms of the comic book collector, the comic book reader, and the moviegoer.
Sure.
And it's like that we're there trying to make sure that we have products that you want to take home with you in the first place. You want to consume. You want to share and talk about with us. Because, as I said, too, is like that's why I love going to conventions so much.
Because
it puts me in the position of the fans that come into our store all the time.
Absolutely. We have to know what's going on now, and we kind of have to know what's going to go on tomorrow, into the future.
Yes.
If you want to know what fans are looking for in your store, and if I want to know what to put into my comic that will keep fans reading it, we kind of got to keep our fingers on the pulse, not only of what's going on now, but again, that that future blip of the heartbeat of this culture we love.
Yes, like for instance, I just put up Booster Gold number one this week in the front case. People are going, Booster Gold number one? What's going on with Booster Gold number one? There's a lot of chatter about a script being worked in somewhere for Booster Gold, whether it's in Legends of Tomorrow, whether it's going to be in a new movie, whether it's going to be in an... oh, gosh, dude.
Well, he's overdue for an appearance in Legends of Tomorrow.
Yes.
I mean, that it makes show perfect is suited sense. For him.
Yes.
So.
I mean, him and Rip Hunter, they did a Geoff Johns Booster Gold series.
Absolutely.
A few years back, and Geoff Johns is in charge of a lot of the script writing still in Hollywood, is he not, for DC?
I believe he is a creative consultant, at the very least.
Yes. And so, you know, if it's something Booster Gold's a character he likes, he'll do his best to make it in there.
Oh, sure. I mean, Hawk and Dove involved in the live-action Titans series.
Yes.
You put out a couple of those issues now, people might be like, what's the big deal with Hawk and Dove, you know? But, gosh, a year from now, people will be clamoring for those appearances. So you gotta know.
Yes.
You gotta know what's coming up.
And I said, too, and comics are doing a really good job right now getting you ready for these movies and TV shows right now. So if you see, like, something of a new Booster Gold TV or comic series announced, that means, okay, we're getting close. You've seen it already, obviously, with the Venom 30th anniversary this year, and the movie's coming out at the end of the year, obviously.
Yep.
The Phoenix Resurrection, huh? Why do we need to bring back Jean Grey after having her on the shelf since 2002, I think it was?
Gosh, really? Has it been that long?
Yeah, she died at the end of Grant Morrison's run, and it was Grant Morrison and Francis Lionel Yu, if I remember correctly, in X-Men number 150.
Well, I guess they
was
brought
the
her
last,
back
like,
in a manner
original
speaking
Jean
with
Grey.
When the kids came back.
That's true, and they did the new X-Men back with Bendis, bringing her back through the time stream.
Yeah.
But it's interesting now, it's supposed to be the old school Jean Grey resurrection.
Sure.
You know, it's funny because they just finished that
series.
And
you're saying this because the X-Men movie's coming out.
Yes, and they have the Dark Phoenix or the Phoenix Saga movie coming out.
Yep.
So we got to make the focus on Jean Grey. And they did the Jean Grey series starting up last year, too, as well, to get us ready for it. But we need the Phoenix Force back.
Sure.
Ironically, the way this Phoenix Resurrection series that just ended this week, which is the time of broadcast January 31st, of actually February 1st today, but it came out yesterday on January 31st. Spoiler alert, so turn off your volume for 13 seconds if you want here. I'll try to make it 13 seconds or less. Like kind of like a, you know, I'll tell you when to start too, because I'd go about the whole, like Mike D'Antoni, if you're Suns fans out here, you know, 13 seconds or less shot clock. But Jean Grey renounced the Phoenix Force, and the Phoenix Force actually left her permanently, which is really an interesting plot twist I did not expect to see happen.
Is it just out there looking for a new host, or...?
It's just that it's... Jean Grey said, like, this is never going to work out between us. It always works out bad. It's almost like she let her down easy. Which is kind of weird seeing,
it's not
like,
you,
the,
Phoenix,
like,
Force, it's me.
Yeah, it's like Spider-Man and Peter Parker, the symbiote suit.
Very similar, yeah.
And I was kind of going, oh, it's interesting. I did not expect that, especially when they call the book Phoenix Resurrection.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean? But as I said, too, who knows what's going to happen with the Phoenix Force? But as of right now, they're more or less said, okay, this is over. We're not going to do this whole Jean Grey Phoenix thing anymore.
The comic's going to be about the gentrification of downtown Phoenix. It's
exactly.
Not even about the X-Men.
Yes.
Phoenix Resurrection. Look at these hipster coffee shops and galleries going on in downtown Phoenix.
Exactly. And we all know, I mean, here's the pun out for our good friends Chris and Adam, who come to the store and say they love my puns. You know, the one thing you can guarantee in comics is death and taxes on your comics.
There you go.
And that same thing could be, you know, in here too. Taxes get resurrected every year, no matter
Boom.
What happens.
There you go,
your pun, Adam and Chris. I mean, not one of my better ones, I feel, but you know, this one was a little bit just for you. So I love it.
Well, you mentioned the black suit Spider-Man, Ken.
Yes.
And let's use that as a transition into our interview for today. We had the great fortune of meeting and dining Mike Zeck, the artist that designed the black suit for Spider-Man just before the Secret Wars.
Yes, black and white suit Spider-Man.
Mike Zeck was in town for Ace Comic-Con earlier this year, and he swung by Drawn to Comics, again, because it's one of the best comic shops to visit in the country, and so he just had to swing by since he was in town.
Well, there's a little bit of a good faith of one of our customers is actually an associate with him.
Sure.
And she helps him out at all the booths that he goes to at cons. And she's a huge Mike Zeck fan, too. And we've bonded like there's no tomorrow about Mike Zeck being one of the coolest creators in our past 40 years.
And
she said, hey, would you like Mike Zeck to come on in? I go, yeah, of course. Yeah. Love to have Mike Zeck come in, you know. Look, dude, black costume Spider-Man. See that thing on the wall? That's the butterfly effect of the store. No black costume, no Drawn to Comics. So
amazing.
you know, where, yeah, dude. So it was just an amazing, amazing moment. So I said, too, yes, we do have the number 5 ranked comic shop in the country, but I don't think Mike Zeck was pulling out his Rolodex. Let's see. I went to 1 through 4. Let's go number 5.
He had his atlas of best comic shops to visit in the country. He saw he was in Phoenix, and he thought, I'll swing by, draw to comic. But, no, he was in town for Ace. Yeah. We were fresh from a press conference with Stan Lee, so we were already riding high.
Yes, dude.
That, you know what? We should save that for another episode.
Hang 10.
That's a story all in itself.
Hang 10 level was awesome.
Oh, yeah.
The waves were like, dude, you're at Seal Beach, the surf capital of the world. You're like, dude, this wave sucks compared to that wave that Ken and Russ went through on that Friday before Ace Comic Con.
Yeah, when we crashed on the shore of your store, we had no idea that another wave was rising.
I know,
it was
dude.
Mike Zeck, who was kind enough to sit down with us for an impromptu interview. So
I didn't have time to re-wax my surfboard before that next wave came in, dude.
I think that's a pun for something, folks. That's a euphemism for something. Sure. Ken's so excited to see Mike Zeck. He's waxing his board. But I just happened to have my laptop and of course my phone, but we set up an impromptu podcast recording booth in the back of the store. Mike sat with us for about 20 minutes or so.
Oh yes.
So it's a short interview, but gosh, did he talk about
everything we wanted to hear.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, dude.
Craven, Black Suit, how he broke into Marvel Comics, meeting Stan Lee. So,
I love his story. I can't wait till you guys hear the story of how Stan Lee decided to bring him on board with Marvel. That was one of the most cool you'll ever hear.
Every fan's dream, and Mike Zeck, being a fan, experienced it.
Yes.
This is like, if you're an artist or a writer and you want to break into the industry, the Mike Zeck model, unfortunately, may no longer exist, but man, you'll live vicariously through this thing, man.
It reminds me of what Micah Grunell told me about Michael Turner. Bringing him into Aspen.
Well, that's true, and much more contemporary. So
yes, and of course, like Stan Lee's the godfather of comics.
Yeah,
and Michael Turner is a guy this is his 10th anniversary of his passing this year in 2018.
Wow, already?
It's insane. Yeah, 2008. I mean, where I was one of the bigger Michael Turner fans you'll ever talk to. Same time you want to talk Michael Turner and his life, this guy, a lot like when it comes to his love and care for comics. Same as Stan Lee's, but on a much micro level, lifespan wise, it is like, I guess, lifespan in comic production.
Yeah.
Jimmy, but I mean, he was a Stan Lee type personality and love for his fans the same way Stan Lee does.
Yeah. And again, his story is much more contemporary, so maybe that dream still is alive where you can be discovered and brought into the industry. So, disregard what I said, that pessimism, throw it out the window, live your dream, follow your dream, live, laugh, love, seize the day, all that stuff.
But I said too, you're totally right though, Stan Lee is the guy that's probably the hardest to impress because he sees everybody show him something.
Oh yeah.
You have to really have a magical talent like Mike Zeck had.
Absolutely.
To get Stan Lee to do what he did, and you'll hear that on the Mike Zeck podcast we have coming, but it's magical to hear stuff like that happening in the industry.
Very cool.
Someone that is so respected and so high level in their industry recognizing talent and giving them an opportunity. Yeah.
So just understand when you're listening to the interview that the recording may not be ideal, the quality of it, but that's not really what we're about anyway. The quality is one thing, but the quantity of content, that's what Drawn to Comics podcast is all about.
Yes.
So
the audio quality, not always up to par. The quality of what content you're getting is always 110%.
How you'll hear it sucks. What you'll hear, amazing. That's what we're talking about.
When you get those like magical filters that will make everything sound crystal clear, in like 20 years from now, you'll be like coming back to these podcasts and going, dude, we got this amplifier right now. We can put this on the satellite and broadcast it from space.
This is, of course, as we're recording in a noisy Mexican restaurant at 9 o'clock in the morning having breakfast. But
no mariachis this morning, though. I'm kind of disappointed.
Oh, well, you know. They could play a Drawn to Comics theme song for us at the beginning. They listen to Drawn to Comics.
That would be awesome. I love mariachis.
Well, on that note, everybody, you're about to hear the amazing Mike Zeck. From the Drawn to Comics podcast, I'm Russ.
I'm Ken.
And we are
Drawn to Comics. Enjoy, guys.
Hey, everybody, you're watching and listening to Drawn to Comics, the podcast about a couple of guys that are just drawn to comics. I'm Russ.
I'm Ken.
We're and here.
I'm also drawn to comics.
Thank you, Mark.
This is a gentleman that's been drawing comics for many years. You may know his work from, gosh, dare we list the credentials? What are you most proud of?
If I had to just pick one, it would probably be Kraven's Last Hunt.
Oh, beautiful.
Just because that was such an incredible story. That I always say everything starts with story, and that story inspired me and everybody after me, all the way down to the letter. You know, we've all said, you know, that it was, you know, that story.
Yeah.
You know, you can't do bad work on a story that good, you know, or else you shouldn't be near it if you're going to do terrible work or something. So we all did our best, you know, just to try to do justice to that story. And, you know, my hope was that other readers, or the readers, you know, when it came out, you know, would see the same thing I saw in the story. And obviously they did. It's 30 years later now. It's never been out of print. It's still talked about. Probably the number one Spider-Man story on the internet that people want to see as a movie.
Oh, that would be awesome. Oh, my gosh.
It would Prince be a, last yeah. Well, movie. That story would be a perfect movie. And even today, it's even been voted number one Spider-Man story of all time on certain internet polls.
Wow!
So I couldn't be more pleased, you know, that people see just how good that story really is.
Just so awesome. You know, that's artist Mike Zeck.
Yes, I was going to say, just to clarify, this is Mike Zeck.
Who's talking with such authority over the story? It's only the guy that drew it.
Yeah. Now, when J.M. DeVita showed you the script, were you like just drop like everybody else that read it for the first time?
Kind of, yeah. And it was a plot, not a script.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I only work plot style at Marvel.
Oh, wow.
But he sent me the plot, and I was able to read it, like, all of it. You know, all six parts, basically. Wow. As soon as I read it, I knew, you know, well, here's the best Spider-Man story I've ever read. You know, and that's what I'm saying, how it inspired everybody. You know, I said, you know, I only hope I can do it justice. And on that story, the very first thing I did were the six covers before I even touched the interior. So I told the story with the six covers, basically, and turned those in. The very first cover I did, obviously, was the fourth part, Spider-Man crawling out of his grave. Mm.
Wow, that's iconic.
That's the one that kind of drew itself, you know.
Number 32 about the Spider-Man, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, how many people really get a chance to get a story where their main character is crawling out of his own grave? That just almost never happens.
Yeah.
So if you get that story and you don't make that the cover, you don't belong in comics. You know? That's going to be it. So I knew that was going to be cover four, and then I worked around backwards and forwards to do the six covers. And start on the story. That was just a fun project.
Yeah, it's like, I was never really a big Kraven the Hunter fan until that story.
Because,
watching Kraven defeat Spider-Man for the first time, and then take on the moniker and do something that Spider-Man's never done, which was defeat Vermin in that story, if I remember correctly, was just something that was unprecedented. The good guy getting defeated, the bad guy becoming the good guy, and then defeating a bad guy the good guy never defeated.
Yeah.
And then, unfortunately, there was even the first time that there was suicide dealt with in comic book storytelling.
That guy didn't really become the good guy. He felt like he could. The ultimate defeat, was that he could be a better Spider-Man than Spider-Man.
That's true.
But that was one of the good parts of the story is that it really brought forward how it's not the costume. Peter Parker is Spider. Yes, the person in the costume. So him doing things that Peter Parker would never do, just showed that difference of, you know, why Peter Parker belonged in the Spider-Man costume. Not someone like Kraven or someone like that.
It's kind of like with the whole Doc Ock taking on being Superior Spider-Man recently in storytelling.
Yeah.
It's like,
but truthfully, that was the part of the story that drew me into it the most, too, was Kraven been around for over 20 years, and no one treated him with any respect ever, and no one ever really defined him until that story. And DeMatteis defined him perfectly. You know, he got that hook of his Russian heritage, and then he knew exactly what Kraven should be. Man, it was just perfect. It was so fun. That one story, you know, then made Kraven one of the best villains, really, in Marvel history. And better that we lost Craven at the end of the series, I think, because I swear, you know, it made me happy, the ending, because I knew if the other writers got hold of Craven again, they'd probably turn him back into just some clownish character or something. Yeah,
fur wearing.
He'd always be using Spider-Man.
Yeah, so, you know, as much as I hated to see him go, I was glad for that reason, you know, that Mark could define him, and then he's finished, done. You know, no one else gets him after that.
I'm curious, and because as the artist, you have the responsibility of doing that visually. So when you look at a character like Craven that's wearing, like, a fur, you know what I mean, and a spiked belt and leopard pants, that looks like a woman going out for the town in Scottsdale now, but at the time, that's unconventional.
Or a
villain.
She-man.
Yeah, right. Yeah. How do you look at an old-school design that may have worked in the Silver Age like that and try to make it a little more contemporary or at least grounded in a story?
Well, remember, you remember the first page?
I'm not as avid a fan of the story as Ken might be.
Was this Spider-Man number 31's first page, right?
He's not wearing a thread.
Oh,
he's
okay.
Totally naked.
Okay.
That's how I dealt with that costume.
Let's just throw the whole thing out the window.
Out it goes.
When he was eating spiders.
Yeah, right. He was taking his jungle drugs.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh, that's right.
Yeah.
He didn't like that. He's Craven the Hunter.
He's
preparing
himself
rest.
For the fight, you know.
That's right.
So he imagines the... You know, the sea of spiders, and it envelops him, completely covers him. He busts out of it, you know, and starts eating spiders.
Yeah, he has no arachnophobia whatsoever.
Halfway through the story, he's got Spider-Man suit on.
Yes.
So that,
what
I
better
guess,
way to train, you know, when you defeat your ultimate foe?
I must eat every spider, then I will be able to defeat this spider.
Yeah. But, you know, I still kept him in, like, the Tarzan loincloth, and we had to keep the vest.
Well, that lion vest is unbelievable.
Yeah, gotta keep it.
Cool.
Yeah.
Not many people can pull it off.
Yeah. Right.
Except Craven, obviously.
Sure.
Because it was on that character.
Yeah.
Well, cool, Ken. I know you're a huge fan of the black Spider-Man costume.
Yeah.
And here's the guy that drew it first, really, right? As far as its mainstream introduction.
Yeah, I created designed the costume for Secret Wars.
So, I'm sure you've been asked this 100 times, but do they just come to you and say, we need a new Spider-Man costume?
That was it. Yeah.
How did that happen? Yes.
Just that way. I mean, Secret Wars was an odd series in a way. That was, and most people know it was sort of a tie-in with the Mattel toy line.
The Secret Wars
toy line. At the same time,
yeah.
So
the shields,
they were
shield
trying to
identities,
figure,
right?
Yeah,
right. Articulating
shields. Articulating shields or something, yeah. But, you know, it was just something that had to be done. They couldn't figure out who to write it, but Jim, being the editor-in-chief, knowing all the characters, you do it, you know, basically. So he got the job. He didn't have time to do the job. And so this was one of those things where unlike Craven's Last Hunt, I didn't get a bunch of plots to read or anything. It was just kind of went along. He did number one, and then here came number two. So I didn't even know what was going to happen throughout the series or anything.
Wow.
But well before it started, he at least was trying to figure out how people would change either emotionally or physically or whatever. And I think the bigger change then was really going to be Spider-Man's going to come back in another costume. And I don't know what you've read. I didn't know it at the time at all, but as it turns out, this kid who turned in a plot like the year before Secret Wars, somewhere in that plot there was a scene where Reed Richards makes Spider-Man a new costume.
Okay.
And that plot never went anywhere. He wasn't really ready to be a writer, but that stayed in the back of Jim Shooter's mind, I guess. And then he brought it out at the perfect time to say, hey, I think we'll bring Spider-Man back in a new costume. And the perfect time, because all this was going to happen on an alien world. So had it happened on somewhere here on Earth, there would have never been
Venom.
There wouldn't have been the living symbiote costume. So great timing on that. Not that we knew, you know, that we only took it as far as it's coming from an alien planet, so it can have some special capabilities, the way it produces web, shoots web, or something like that. But Yeah, but that was it. That and some other things that I had to design prior to starting the book so that the other artists would know what to do when all these heroes were coming back after Secret Wars.
It was kind of like the first, I would say, Marvel reboot of the universe in a weird way of saying that. Would you say that? Because She-Hulk joined the Fantastic Four. Spider-Man got the black costume.
Mm-hmm.
Thing left behind on the planet.
Right.
So that's why Thing wasn't in the Fantastic Four.
Definitely a shakeup.
Captain America's shield was busted for the first time in that story,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
and
true.
It was the Wasp died.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Kitty Pryde and Colossus broke up.
Like,
Secret Wars was kind of the first crisis to a universe.
Yeah.
And then, ironically, Crisis on Infinite Earths came out the year afterwards. Did you know that, did you have that feeling as you were doing Secret Wars, like this would have that kind of impact on comics long-term, too?
No, I'm, you know.
Well, so just like Mattel saying, hey, give us the story.
Well, obviously, putting all the heroes and all the villains together, we said, it should do well.
Yeah, for sure.
It should. Yeah,
but then it's like it changed your whole outcome of the characters.
It obviously
afterwards.
Did far better than we expected because it had to go to second printings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't know it was going to do that
They were the three-packs. I remember as a kid going to Target and getting Secret Wars in three-pack issues. The only time I ever saw that was with Star Wars and Transformers. I guess at one point, too, they were doing Transformers packs during that era.
And I think because it was one of the first of that kind of maxi series big event thing, that's why it did so well. But the other thing that happened, and no other series can, I think, can really claim this, but to me, the biggest success of Secret Wars was how many new readers it brought into the industry.
Oh, for sure.
That's the real success.
I was one of them, I gotta say.
Other series sold lots, but no other series brought in readers like Secret Wars did. I've never done a show in the 30-plus years that since Secret Wars has been out that a number of people, not just one person, a number of people, everybody comes to my table, so many of them say, here's the one, Secret Wars 8, what... Secret Wars 1, this is the one that got me into comics, or my dad got me this, this is what, how I got into comics, or got into art.
Yes.
When I hear it all the time. It's just unbelievable, you know, how many people.
Well,
and that's, you know, that's, like I said, to me, that's the greatest success of that book.
Just made an observation in my head talking with you here. It's
like
every black costume character you touched looked more awesome afterwards. Obviously, I'm going to let you tell a story that lets you set up for this here, too. The first one I was experienced, too, was the Black Costume Spider-Man.
Yeah.
But then Punisher. And then Snake Eyes over in G.I. Joe.
Is
there one that you enjoyed drawing the most out of those three?
The Punisher.
The Punisher?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
And it's like, I always like, love to see a Punisher versus Snake Eyes sketch for me. That would be probably the most unbelievable battle of Mike Zeck art I think you would ever see for fans out there.
Yeah.
Just put it out there for
me. I'm curious, how many artists thanked you for the no webs on Spider-Man's costume?
You'd be surprised how much that people made that comment, you know, that I did a black costume because I was too lazy to draw webbing. And it wasn't that at all. You know, I was just trying to do I always say that if you put 10 people in a room then and said, create a Spider-Man costume, everybody thinks of a spider as being black, pretty much. So I always say, well, you get 10 black costumes, you know, from those 10 people. So I don't consider that, you know, genius designing or anything. That's what anyone would do.
It makes sense. It's like logical. It's like that maybe
so,
drawn to as a kid.
Yeah, so I just started with the silhouette and then designed the white elements, but purposefully trying to make it kind of sleek and simple and... Not because I didn't want to draw webbing, just because that was, you know, that was what I wanted to do, you know, to make it very, very different than what came before.
Yeah, and I said, too, there was a story that you told me earlier tonight when you walked in, and we're here at Drama Comics in downtown Glendale with Mike Zeck, Russ Kazmierczak, and I'm Ken Brown. How did you get started in comics? Or no, how did you get hired by Marvel? My apologies.
Well
I like both, actually,
both.
Because your career would have begun in the early 70s?
Yeah. 74 was my first Charlton work.
Okay.
So started professionally in 74.
Oh my gosh, that's the year I was born. I don't want to make anybody, it's like, oh, I just, parallels that are not significant at all, but so awesome in their own way.
And did you have aspirations to work in the industry? Were you doing graphic design work earlier?
From a toddler, that's all I wanted. I was one of those strange people. everybody talks about, I wish I was born with talent. Well, you know, I always tell them, nobody's born with talent. You know, you're not born knowing how to do something. I said, and you can go to interviews of so many, you know, whether it's people in the arts or music or acting or sports. And those people that are successful, so many times you hear the same thing. I knew what I wanted to do even as a kid. I call it like Tiger Woods syndrome. You know, you put a golf club in a five-year-old's hands and you keep it there, he's going to be good when he's an adult. Just on the basis of that much training, experience, practice. And I think that's the advantage that all these people that are successful have, compared to the people that don't even know what they want to do when they go to college. They still don't know what they want to do, you know, really in life. But who knows? Who knows why I was obsessed? You know, I don't know. Why comics? I have no idea. But there was never a time in my life that I didn't have comics and wasn't trying to draw them. So that's what I said. You know, it's like Tiger Woods. You know, if I started at 5 years old trying to draw comics, I better be a little bit, you know, a little bit good, you know, by the time I'm 18, 20, you know, whatever, I should be. But there's the advantage. Yeah, I was terrible when I was 5, obviously, and I was terrible when I was 7 and 10 and so on, but I just kept at it.
So then you had a portfolio, and you just walk into Charlton Comics?
I did send my portfolio around, and again, I started to make those trips to that big New York convention in the 70s, and since it was in New York, the publishers were there.
Mm-hmm. Is that where you lived at the time?
No, I was in Fort Lauderdale. I was in South Florida.
Okay, so yeah, you're flying out.
I was in total vacuum down there. There were no other artists down there or anything. Yeah, I was just flying solo down there trying to figure out what to do. But everybody kind of liked my stuff. There just wasn't, you know, there just wasn't immediate work for me. Charlton was first that came up with some work for me, and that worked well. And truthfully, you know, I wasn't that good. I really needed that few years of training ground at Charlton. It really was a good thing for me. And the story I told you, and we can finish with that, because it's kind of nice, because Stan Lee's here this weekend for the show. Yes. I know you already got to see him today.
Oh my gosh, that was a bucket list that I never thought would be filled.
I had to adjust the lens on the camera because you're glowing so brightly.
Thank
Garrett Sheamus for that there, too. The mayor, Jerry Wires of Glendale, who contacted us about being part of that, because we're a pretty big supporter of comics in this community.
Yeah.
It's surreal about how communities will support comic books, and the love for it is shared among so many people. That's what I'll let you keep on going. Thank you.
Yeah. So after we talked about Stan today, and I told you about the first time I met Stan, which is actually 1975.
Wow.
So we go back quite a ways, and that was at they were doing a big Miami Beach convention, or planning one. And I was very excited that I was going to be a guest, because I was already working at the Charlton Horror Titles. But their big guests, obviously, were Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, and Neil Adams. And
wow.
I was going to get a chance to meet all three of these guys at the same time. And,
yes.
And so that was really, really big weekend for me, obviously, to meet them all. But the standout really was Stan, because he... I had my complete Charlton story laid out, you know, on my table, and he came up, and he was so gracious. He was just gushing. You know, he thought the work was great, you know, and I've read the interviews. I read Stan's soapbox, and he was just like that guy. You know, oh, this is great, Mike, and you should be working for Marvel. And, you know, I'm thinking, wow, what a nice guy, you know, to tell me all this stuff. And I was pointing out some other things that I had done, and he just could, you know, he just was acting like he, you know, was so blown away by my work. But, you know, I just thought that was Stan being Stan. Until after all this happens, then he actually got on the phone and called the Marvel offices to talk to the editor and said, "I just met this guy. You know, you need to give this guy some work." You know, and I'm going,
"What?"
You know, I couldn't believe he did it. You know, because I was really thinking all along it was just Stan being Stan, but he saw something, you know, in my work. And just like he saw in other, you know, I mean, obviously he'd been in that business so long, he
knows
knew,
talent. He sees
yeah,
talent.
He knew to recognize potential, at least, I guess. So, and what I said was, you know, that's when Stan became a superhero to me. He's been a superhero ever since. So, 75, and then I met Marvel. I actually got to work with him on a small project, and we got to go up on stage with him a few years back. In fact, that was around the 40th anniversary from the first time I met him. Was when then we were on stage, a whole bunch of us at a show, trying to, you know, honoring him for his work and stuff. So very, very nice.
Yeah, it's like it's Stan Lee, Mike Zeck working together in projects that are kind of like today legendary. I mean,
absolutely.
I don't think there's anything you can do but call it legendary works that Stan Lee, Mike Zeck, and these creators of now modern mythology have done for the comic industry. And it's just, that's it too. It leaves me speechless. I'm kind of like, that sounds weird. I used to watch a lot of Saturday Night Live growing up, and I'm verklempt. From Coffee Talk. This is Ken, and we're talking comics, and I'm verklempt. Not very often that happens. But
well, Mike, thanks a lot, man, for sitting down with
surreal.
Us and chatting for a few minutes.
My pleasure.
This was fantastic.
What a great store. Everybody should come out here to draw into comics. It's just great. One of the best comic shops I've been in, for sure.
Wow.
Cool.
That's an honor. I greatly appreciate it.
Yeah.
That's a great way to end
yes.
it.
Yeah. Hopefully see everybody this weekend at the show.
At Ace.
Yeah.
Yes.
At Ace.
Well, for Drawn to Comics, I'm Russ.
I'm Ken.
I'm Mike.
We are Drawn to Comics. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, you guys. That's outstanding, Mike. Thank you so much, sir.
This episode of the Drawn to Comics podcast is brought to you by Drawn to Comics, the store for which this very podcast was named. Operating out of downtown Glendale, Arizona since 2005, Drawn to Comics is a family-run business that offers fans of all ages everything they want from comic book culture. New issues, back issues, discounted issues, apparel, posters, pins, Funko Pops, and so much more. Make sure you check out their Toy Attic, featuring action figures from all of your favorite franchises. That's DC and Marvel Comics, Star Wars and Star Trek, The Walking Dead, Masters of the Universe, G.I. Joe, Transformers, and that's just to name a few. Nominated by TravelandLeisure.com as one of the best comic book stores to visit in the entire country, Drawn to Comics serves the greater Phoenix metropolitan area. You can find them online at DrawnToComics.com or on Instagram at Drawn to Comics. If you'd like to be a sponsor of this podcast, just email DrawnToComicsPodcast@gmail.com. And thanks for listening to the Drawn to Comics podcast.